Welcome back, Badgers. My name is Sam Cooper, and I'm a golf course architect, and I'm joined by my great friend, James Bledge. Bledge, do you want to say hello?
Hello, hello everyone. Yeah. I'm here. Moving closer to the microphone. I'm here, and I've got a little aperitif for tonight.
Look at this. I think someone unofficial sponsor is back.
The fact that I hadn't been drinking during the podcast.
Drinking so, and podding.
Sacrilege. This is actually this time last week, Sam, that we were at the start of a 8-hour bender in London.
It was. Should we briefly? We're not going
well,
to talk.
That was Wednesday night. That was Wednesday night. It wasn't Thursday.
It was all a blur. We needn't talk at length because I think that our day on the Thursday deserves a special mention of its own. But should we give the exec overview, Bledge, of our little trip down the road?
Are we starting from Wednesday?
Yeah. So I think Wednesday was just as integral.
I'm actually drinking a BrewDog Black Heart Draft Stout, which is a Guinness ripoff. Yeah. Oh, look, yeah.
A Scottish version of Guinness.
Look at, and it settles like Guinness as well, as you can see. And I'm drinking out of Guinness glass, but it's a lovely little tipple. BrewDog Black Heart Draft Stout.
And other stouts are available.
Yeah, but it's got a massive hint of coffee in it, which is nice.
Well, hopefully that will keep you going through this podcast, Badge.
Last Wednesday, you and I travelled down to London to see our friend James Day at Urban Golf. Shout out Urban Golf for all your inner city golf needs. You want to explain what it's all about, Sam?
Well, I can't imagine that there is a single listener to this podcast who hasn't already been to Urban Golf. But just in case someone has been living in a bit of a cave, a cave is probably a good way of describing Urban Golf, isn't it? But it's a cave for absolute golf sickos. So James Day of Urban Custom Clubs on Instagram. He's also one of the guys behind Sounder. And he's the guy who I always turn to for actual golf clubs. And James is a wonderful friend of ours. And he set up Urban Golf 20 years ago, actually, this year. Did you know, Bledge?
Oh, yes. So,
yes 20 years yeah. old. So he had an idea for simulated golf in London long time before people could actually imagine simulators working properly. And he had that same kind of realization, I think, and almost had to invent his own simulators. And they're so good. Like they actually work, and it's such a great place to hang out. And James has an absolute Aladdin's cave of old golf clubs, isn't he? Retro clubs, and he tinkers all day and makes things. And his level of understanding, I just think is well, it's higher than anyone I've ever met. He just understands it, doesn't he?
I mean, he is. When we're talking about badgers, he's a definition. He's a golf club collector badger. I mean, his rack is full of beautiful Japanese forgings, old woods, old metal heads, rare irons. He's got a set of Seve's golf clubs when he had Sounder irons. And the great thing about it, and Sam and I are with him and our good friend Fraser Peacock, and we played 18 holes round Sawgrass on his simulator. And you're just pulling any club off the rack and having a bash, you know. And I think that's the best part for me, really.
I think one of the great stories that to me sums up James as a person and gives probably a little glimpse behind the curtain on what he's like. He loves Miuras, builds loads of Miura sets for clients, friends, whatever, and there was a particular iron head. You might know it, Bledge. I'm not a club badger like you are, really. But there was a particular head that they made, and I think it's when Miura was sold to 8AM Golf.
Yes.
And, you know, before that, James would say, you know, they're still probably by far and away the best in terms of their manufacturing. But it was just, you know, undoubtedly the peak of sort of equipment manufacturing, really. And when it was sold, there was a particular iron that he loved, and he bought, did he say 36 sets?
He bought every set in Europe, he said. It's like the old TaylorMade 200 series. That's the kind of what it was modeled on.
But the mirror equivalent.
Shallow cavity, yeah.
And he bought 36 sets, laid them all out, and he said, you know, they're all so close to one another in terms of how they're made, but because they're made by hand by blokes in Japan, they all have very, very slight subtle differences. And he said, you lay out every single six iron head, every single seven iron head, and you know, he told this great story about making every time he sold a set, he'd sort of cherry pick the best ones, and ended up with the last set that he had was the pick of the bunch of this last remaining line of clubs. But I think that speaks to James's character. He's a fantastic little aficionado. So we went to see him, and we had a great evening. And then you slept soundly, didn't you, that night?
Well, when you turn up at the back of 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you have a pint, it's a bit early, and I knew that it was gonna go downhill after that. And after leaving probably at the back of 1 o'clock in the morning, well, I remember actually the highlight of my night was the 17th hole at Sawgrass when
you stiffed it, yeah.
Yeah, I hit to 5 inches. I couldn't even see the ball. But Sam got up. It was his responsibility to get our digs in the city, and not one to scrimp and save. Sam got us a beautiful 6-star penthouse apartment in the train station at Euston, and you slept all right, but. Like I couldn't
dripping
get over the
an iron,
fact that,
dripping an irony there, I think, Bledge. When did hotels get so expensive? It's 350 quid a night to stay in a travel lodge in London. So I found a cracking little step up from a hostel right next to Euston. Perfect. 80 quid. I slept soundly. But you were slightly kept awake by the fact they were drilling a tunnel for the HS2 connection into Euston directly.
All night.
So maybe that does explain why we got such a bargain there. But then we woke, having myself fully rested and yourself looking slightly dishevelled. And off we went to the Grove, didn't we?
Yeah, guests of Husqvarna at the Grove on Thursday, which was really cool. We were meant to be playing with Harry Redknapp, but he seen that it was with me and Sam and called off, and we played with two lovely gentlemen.
I think he arranged a dentist appointment instead.
Yeah, he was in a shower. He was washing his hair. But we played with two lovely guys from, one lad was from Dunsborough Castle area. Shout out to Mark and Jake, lovely guys, and we had a super game round there.
Paul and Max, I think. One had the swing of Paul Casey, and one had
Paul Casey and Max Homer.
Exact look of Max Homer. It was uncanny, actually. They were lovely golfers.
I was very lucky. It was a scramble, and just let you guys get on with it, and I just kind of...
We had a good day, didn't we?
Good day.
Super, we made it back. And
Peter Crouch was there, Kirsty Gallagher.
Yeah, Jimmy Bullard was there, and
that was our friend Jimmy.
We had a wonderful day, but I think that we will cover that properly, and the reason we were there on a separate episode, do that properly. And instead, we've thought we'd try something a little different again. And we've been doing this recently, or we've been doing these episodes of late. You know, we keep trying a few different things at your suggestion, the listeners' suggestions. And we had a question a few weeks ago that basically suggested, Bledge, that you and I agree on everything, that we don't have any difference of opinion, and that we're becoming very, very, very boring, which I don't doubt. But we thought I thought, why don't we put it to the test and try and combine it with a few other questions that have come into the podcast. Remember, do keep them coming in. hello@golfbadgers.com if you'd like to email in any questions at all. But we thought, well, why don't we see if we do agree? And we looked at some of our favorite things. So we've pulled together some categories. Some of them are just a bit of fun. And we'll breeze through these, see how many we do agree on. It's almost like a Mr. and Mister, this little segment, isn't it? But see how many of our things line up. So some are fun. Some are sort of a bit about ourselves and our golfing experiences and what we like. But then we thought it's also a good chance of coming into another question that this has come up a few times from people of our favorite holes and favorite golf courses. And we thought we could give some specific examples of them and then really try and get under the hood of why they're good. You know, I love on this podcast coming back to the why. And it's all well and good to say, oh, I really like the whatever, the seventh hole at such and such a place. And then we can all nod and smile and go, oh, yeah, lovely. But I pledge want to really dial into it and say, why? What makes it good? What makes it special? And some of them will be recurring themes that we've talked about in other episodes. But I think it's probably a bit more interesting when we sort of anchor them to specific holes that people might be able to. Might have played themselves or can go and look at a flyover on YouTube or go and have a look on Google Maps or whatever and see if we're chatting absolute rubbish or not. So with that in mind, should we start at the trivial end, Bledge? And the first thing that you put on the spreadsheet, beautiful spreadsheet that you made here, was Twitter pages.
Hmm.
So, or Twitter accounts, you called them pages. Twitter accounts, what are the, what would be your top five, top three? What would be your top three ones
that people should follow? I'm going to have to whittle down at the ones that I brainstormed, right? The one that I enjoy looking at most is probably recently, keep it especially, is at McKee Group. And it's a guy who does shaping work, and he hangs his phone or his GoPro or whatever it is from his digger cab and does time lapses. I find them really therapeutic to watch. And I think that even if you're not a greenkeeper or have got no interest in it, I think a lot of people would just love watching someone using a tilt rotate bucket with that kind
it's
of
a great
skill. I
mean, skill, isn't it?
He's a wizard. An absolute wizard. I'm not sure if he listens to the podcast. I don't know who he is, but at McKee, so that's MCKIE Group, GROUP. So that's my first one.
Okay.
Another one. I've really enjoyed Jason Norwood's stuff recently. He's in a golf course way up north. Let me just, of my old age memory, let me remember until then. Norwood. Jason was Toro Student Greenkeeper of the Year a few years back. He's at Ray Golf Club. He's a head greenkeeper there. So
oh, is he at Ray?
Yeah,
of course I have. Yeah, Ray's got some cracking holes. North Coast of Scotland, just west of John O'Groats on that sort of headland there near Thurso. And from memory, I think you play 1, 2, 3, I'm going to say around the 4th, 5th, 6th, you play these beautiful holes around the bay, proper links holes, cracking spot. And I think thinking to the east, you've probably got, I guess you've got to go round the corner to Wick. But then from west of Ray, I'd say you've probably got Durness would be the next one. Trying to think where Thurso is. Thurso must be nearby. But it's a great spot. I didn't realise that's where.
Yeah. Well, what I love about Jason. So Jason was from a golf course in Harrogate as well. So he moved his family all the way up there. First course manager's job. And the stuff he puts on is pretty much the kind of stuff I believe in greenkeeping, like just dead, straightforward, simple, great cultural practices and not using anything too fancy. And he just documents it really well. So great pictures.
Tricky climate, tricky place to work, I should imagine. Mm-hmm. all the way up there. You know, it will be cold until. And I mean, when do you think his growing season is going to be? We should get him on the podcast and ask.
Just August.
Yeah.
he's also taking his kids to Harrogate, which is pretty cool. There's a picture of the kids on a true turf roller. So
fantastic.
Brave man. But he's a good guy, Jason. But I really like his Twitter page. So
go on and give us one more. At, well, we'll put these all in the show notes.
Jason, right, one more. Stuart Langhorn. I quite like Stuart Langhorn. Stuart is a Parkland course manager at, God, here we go again.
Spend half the podcast on Google nowadays, Bledge.
Right.
Is he Basingstoke? Stuart,
is it Beaconsfield?
Beaconsfield.
But again, really great picture. Stuart does loads of good work. I kind of followed his progress since taking on the job, and it looks like he's really turned his Parkland golf course around. Someone that is totally different to what I do, but lots of respect for him. And great page. So, yep, Stuart Langhorn. So that is at Langhorn_Stuart.
Well done. Should I rattle through my Twitters?
Yes.
I realised the other day I've really stopped using Twitter for whatever reason. I'm not an anti-Musker or anti-X. I've just fallen out of the habit. And I've sort of decided I'm going to make a bit of a conscious effort to reacquaint myself with it, because there are some great people out there to follow. And, you know, all seriousness, Bledge, I probably wouldn't say this unless I was on the spot, but you're a pretty good follow on Twitter.
Thank you.
But I imagine that's not really adding much value to our listeners. instead, a previous guest of the podcast, I do think that UK golf guy David Jones is a great follow on Twitter, because he not only tweets about stuff in the same way most people do, but he actually sort of I think goes above and beyond in terms of collating stuff, stimulating debate, and often, you know, there'll be whole threads that I will come back to Twitter and see have got hundreds and hundreds of people chatting about something, be it a ranking list or a part of the world, an obscure part of the world, or whatever it may be. So David's one of my favorite guys in sort of the golfing world. So UK golf guy is definitely on my short list. I'll tell you another one is Hainsey. I can't remember Hainsey's actual handle.
Simon Haynes.
I think it's Hainsey 76, maybe something like that. But I'll tell you what, if you want to see some Hainsey black and white photos of golf courses, he's your man. And who wouldn't? Who wouldn't want to see? He's just... So Simon, for those who haven't come across him, he doesn't work in the golfing world. He plays golf at Copteith. He's just the most charming man. Very, very smart bloke, and loves it. And I think for years and years, whenever he saw an old photo, an old postcard or whatever it might have been of a golf course, he took a photo of it and put a little description, put it in a Google Drive, and he's done it for so long that he has almost become one of the de facto people that if we were actually looking at refurbishing a golf course, I'd give Hainsey a call and say, have you got any photos of... you know, whatever course it may be, have you got any old photos of it? And, you know, why is that important? I think that, you know, if you've got a course that was designed by someone that guaranteed will look a lot very different now from what it was originally, there'll be so many things that are probably still there in the ground, maybe overgrown, that once formed part of the integral part of the whole. And going and having a look at some of those photographs and trying to work out what the architects were trying to achieve. It may be that that doesn't work anymore for all manner of reasons, but it's always such an important thing to do, to be respectful of the history and the the architectural pedigree of the courses, and also because often they're just really cool photos. So Hainsey, Hainsey's
big following as well, Sam. And almost 9,000 followers.
Well, there you go.
A lot of people are interested in it.
It's not just me who's that sad. And I'm going to, who else? I've written a few. I wrote Clate, my colleague, because obviously he's pretty good on Twitter. But
and he talks a lot about rolling the ball back and stuff.
Yeah,
he does.
Well, Clates is just Clate. You get Clates on any subject, and he can speak masterfully. Yeah, he doesn't
muck his words about.
No, he doesn't. He has an opinion, and I love that about him. But I'm actually going to say Michael Verity. Do you follow Michael Verity?
Yes. Yep.
Vez is. There was an old Cookie Jar podcast that I think he was on. And Vez is just, you know, normal bloke, works in the gambling industry, I think, and always sort of has a little interesting angle on things. And I went back and looked at some of the tweets that I liked, and I noticed that quite a few of them were tweets of his. So I thought, Vez, you deserve special mention. So those are my three. Pledge, and we'll put
I
them
actually
in the
don't
show
follow
notes.
Him on Twitter. I follow him on Instagram, I think, not on Twitter. Yeah.
Well, should we do quickly? I'm guessing Instagram will be different for you, Pledge.
Yes, I sort of. I mean, Staglinks, really. Staglinks Society, of which are you part of Staglinks, Sam?
I don't regularly feature. I'm probably not good enough.
So maybe you could tell everyone what Staglinks is, because it's something I've really enjoyed watching since moving up here.
Is it really? I
enjoy it.
Stagship was just our WhatsApp group. It's just our mates that, you know, we've known for years and years and years. But really, it's Elliot, a guy called Elliot Smith. He's a really good golfer. Give him his dues, Elliot. And if people have watched this, he's the guy whose trousers are always a bit too short. But you know, he just thought, why don't we actually, when we go out for an evening match and on the links, why don't we actually post this? And you know, I think a few of us go, who the hell wants to watch that? But sometimes you do watch back through the story and you find yourself getting sucked in on
it's very well filmed. It's very well filmed, the way they do it on a phone, you know, because they get, I mean, it does make them look really good, and I'm sure they're bloody brilliant golfers, but I mean, there's a lot of big putts drained, and it sometimes goes down to the wire.
Well, I can tell you one thing from behind the scenes, there's none of this YouTuber golf crap where they take about five goes and pick the best shots.
Yeah, that's what I like about it, you know, and it's funny as well, and we have Hornsby on it who cracks me up, and I mean, Matty Jordan, who finished, obviously, he's a member here and finished 10th at the Open, he's featured in it, so yeah, it's really good. I don't know, it's just Staglinks Society, I think.
Staglinks, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So what else have you got, Bledge?
My old pal Chris Bernard down at Littlestone, the course manager there. So that's Chris RM7. Chris does the most beautiful photography of golf courses or wildlife or anything, and his Instagram page is excellent. You know, I could have just went with the usual stuff because, I mean, you look in most guys' search pages and it's guitars, golf clubs, women, whatever. But I thought I would pick three that were, yours is Taylor Swift, 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 Taylor Swift. Nine tiles off.
No shame.
And so Chris is very, very good. I really love a bit of photography. Zach Blair's Instagram is really good. You know, he's with a tree farm and stuff. Loved watching that and just seeing all the updates. But I mean, the Instagram thing's hard for me because there's so much of it that's good. I love looking at photographs. It's my favorite thing in the world. So, and videos. So,
yeah. Well, it's a drug we're all addicted to, isn't it? I should imagine. But I wouldn't disagree with any of your choices there, Bledge. I struggled on this one a bit for similar reasons. There's so many great people out there. Urban Custom Club. So, you know, we've already talked about James Day. I love his stuff when he talks, when he does the videos about how he makes a set of clubs and what he's thinking and swing weights and all. I think he's great. Obviously, my great friend, or our great friend, Joe McDonnell, who I work with on a bunch of different things. We do the artwork, the maps that you might have seen on the Value 18 website. So Joe and I did those together, and he's just the most talented artist. And now we get to work, we work together in the architectural world. And, you know, he sort of, I'll go out and do a design of something, and Joe makes it come to life. And it's actually, you know what, Bledge, I was thinking about this today. It's really changed the way I particularly look at working with clients. We've been fortunate enough to bring on board a couple of pretty big clients in the last couple of, well, this week actually, three big clients that hopefully we can talk about at a slightly later date. And, you know, we are very much a firm, don't have 100 clients at all, have very few really, work sparingly, and places where we think that we can add real value. Often places that are underrated, I would say, is a common theme, and then places where, you know, just getting and making the most of what they have, and trying to take some of the worst holes or the weakest holes on the course and replace them with some of the best holes is a formula that I always like to try and lead with. But I'll tell you what, when we have something that, you know, we've worked on with contour lines and two dimensions, and then Joe sends me a video, and he'll just send me a WhatsApp with a Vimeo link to something he's put together. And I always get excited when he does it, because I know it's just going to blow me away. So everything that he ends up putting on his Instagram is of a similar kind of vein. So if anyone doesn't follow, I think he's Joe McD Golf would be his Instagram. If anyone doesn't follow him, then they're really missing out. So he would be one. Likewise, Will Eager Golf, Eager. I'm very proud to say that with my release of my upcoming book series, Will has contributed illustrations of the golf courses to the series, really, which, oh, Bledge, just wait till you see it. It's a different gravy. He's so good. He's so talented. I absolutely adore Will. And I think Joe and Will, for my money, they're the best sort of artists working in golf at the moment. And, you know, that is a high accolade, because you think of some of the other people who are out there, and there are no shortage of talented people. But for me, stylistically, I think they're fantastic.
So I played golf with Will at the Cookie Jar spring or summer.
Did you?
Not Cleve Hill, but
was it the West Byfleet one?
No, with
the cattle.
Yes, because I remember my clubs fell over in a cow pot, and I had a cow crap all down my shafts.
Was it just after you shanked one into a bunker?
That's kind of seamless link there to Cookie Jar, and there's no better really anyone at social media than them guys. That guy goes out saying, I love all their stuff. The best ever. Brilliant.
And can I give one more, Bledge?
One more each, because I've just thought another
one. Okay, good. Go on, you go.
Mick Harris.
Oh, Mike Harris. Monthly Mike Harris.
Yes.
Well, former editor of, now he's...
I love it when he plays here, because the photographs that he takes and stuff make the course look 100 times better than what it is. When he played, we played with you the other week, and he posted all his photographs and his journey of his session. I was like, God, the place looks amazing. He takes really good photographs of the place. It looks shiny. So Mike.
That was funny. So I'm very bad at, actually, believe it or not, of taking photographs when I play golf. I like to sort of put my phone in my bag and just crack on. But Mike and I played together. We're both Liverpool University alumni, and we had a day And, you know, we're slightly different vintages, but we both went there and we were paired together all in the same four. And I looked afterwards, pulled my phone out of my bag, and saw I'd been tagged in about 17 different Instagram posts. And it was one of about 50 stories. But he's just good. Loves it, doesn't he? He's so good. He's got so much passion, even having been the editor of Golf Monthly for years and years and years. Good shout. Can I give my final one, I always make a point that I don't really care for clubs and I don't really care for practice and instruction, but I am acutely aware that two of my recommendations between James Day's account and this one are sort of betraying that claim. And my favorite ever golf coach pledge: do you follow Speed Golf Rob?
Yes.
Marich.
Yeah, he's Marich, yeah. I struggle to get my, I love it. He's brilliant. And everything they say is makes sense. It's the Marco Grady.
It just
Grady
makes sense. It's like, every time you watch it, it's like, oh, I've spent playing golf. And he's right, you know, it's so skim a stone, you know, just have the movement, you're skimming
a stone. No!
I think he's absolute genius. So
he's very funny. What's his handle?
I think he's Speed Golf Rob. But people will know him as the
when they see him because he looks like a tramp.
People know him as the bushy bearded Irishman wearing yellow galoshes and screaming, probably standing in a stream throwing a stick around or something.
He's genius.
Never has so much sense been spoken in a nonsensical manner. He's absolutely fantastic.
It's nuts. It's very good. Very good.
Okay, Bledge. Well, that's our fun little social media rabbit hole. Let's scroll over on. We've got quite a few on here. Should we spend
about something a bit more serious?
If we're looking for serious, shall we move on to something that is very serious? Before we talk about the stuff that we actually are qualified to talk about and, you know, what the holes and courses may be, or at least qualified to some degree, why don't we carry on talking about things that we have no right to offer an opinion on and talk about spike bars? Bars, clubhouse terror. So the two different categories here. Spike bar and clubhouse bar in general. And then a separate category, terrace/balcony.
Right, okay.
Where do you want to start?
So what were the two ones, clubhouse or
Let's start with clubhouse terrace/balcony. An outside space to have a drink.
An outside space, right. I'm going to start with walking.
I had walking. I think we might have. This might be the one we agree on
end up agreeing on it.
Just you wait, right. Don't worry. I think we'll have a severe divergence in a minute.
But,
I had walking.
But, I mean, the only thing strange about walking is it's not on the 18th, is it?
No, but I think anywhere where you're sat having a drink and at any given time there is a risk of getting hit by a golf ball just elevates it to a class of its own.
Uh-huh, definitely. So that's a cracker for me.
Yeah.
Right, on you go then, pal. You go.
Well, I'm going to do the one that you should have started with, which obviously is Deal. Because Deal does
I think people are going to get bored of me ranting, raving on about Deal, so I've left Deal.
Well, I'll do it for you. But Deal is one of the great terraces, balconies there. No more needs to be said on Deal.
Well, I actually probably should, because I have a wee story about that.
Go on.
I've hit the clubhouse on many an occasion there, and they used to say that you were never a real Deal member until you've hit the ball on the beach, hit the clubhouse, or done a bar dive, and I've done all of which numerous times. But my favourite clubhouse story was playing an outpost club match, which I'm heading back in 2 weeks' time to play, hopefully. I was playing with Richard Levine and Matt Chaplin, and the wind, hard wind, coming off the left. I've hit a drive, a nervous half-cut drive into the car park. Hits the clubhouse, bang, bang, roundabout everywhere. And Ollie Banks came out. Oh, what's happened out here? Oh, someone's hit a car at a clubhouse and hit a car, smashed the windscreen. He's like, oh, brilliant. I love it when that happens. It's so funny. What car was it? Oh, is that Golf, Volkswagen Golf down there? All right, yeah, that's mine. So, and right enough, the ball, right, big. Like,
and it was your drive?
For the windscreen. Yeah. And at Cara and Ollie's wedding, my table place, it was a Polaroid picture of the ball in the windscreen.
Fantastic.
Which I've still got to this day.
Has anyone ever hit the... Because I can absolutely see from that tee, for those who haven't played Deal, the club, you know, you sort of leave the clubhouse, cross the road, go walk left towards the first tee, and then you drive back sort of parallel then with the road to, you know, obviously if you do a slice, then you can do exactly as Bledge described. Is it possible to hit the balcony? Because the balcony
I've hit the balcony as well.
Really?
Yeah, the balcony.
That feels like a sneaky long way.
I hit the balcony and I hit the guy who was responsible for bringing the 1.72 ball to Britain.
Well, there you go. If you'd had the smaller ball, then you might not have hit him. It would have carried further.
Yeah, he was sitting in his golf buggy underneath the balcony, and I hit the balcony and ricocheted around and hit him as well. So, yeah.
Well, there's a bit of a common theme here, isn't there? Sort of places you can sit outside and be at risk of something dangerous happening. Hollandwell is another one for me, which isn't... I didn't put it on my list because it's not really a terrace/balcony, but I always think there, when you are sat outside on the grass, and people are playing down the third, and there is always the sneaky risk that someone will overcook that and you could have a ball in your pint glass if you're not too careful.
Mm-hmm.
But where else, Bledge,
my absolute favourite outside of Deal, St George's Hill. I think magnificent clubhouse to sit outside in the balcony because you can look over the first and 10th tees and right over the heath. When one of the most memorable days that we had there was when Gary Peddy showed myself, Fraser, Kobo, Irvin round the clubhouse and took us right up onto the roof. We climbed like through the boiler room and stuff to get right up onto the roof, and it was unreal from up there. So yeah, inside and out, and the golf course, St George's Hill.
Have you seen the old photos of St George's Hill? When did that clubhouse used to have a thatched roof?
Did it not burn down years and years ago?
I think it was the same developer who built it as the clubhouse at Wentworth. So if you can't visualize the clubhouse at St George's Hill, which is definitely worth a Google, it looks like a castle.
It does.
You can probably imagine the clubhouse at Wentworth, and it probably then makes lots of sense. If I think I'm right in saying they were built by the same bloke. But can you imagine that with a thatched roof on? I mean, what an extraordinary building as it is, let alone with a thatched roof.
Yeah, I've just Googled it. I've got a picture here. It's got a thatched roof.
Yeah. Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, that is nice. It's pretty cool. God, it was amazing back then. But yeah, what a place. Isn't it cool? And it's going to be getting renovated soon as well, or restored. A lot of work done there. But yeah, inside and out, that clubhouse is great, isn't it? Well, I love the pillars with all the names of the competition winners or captains or whatever, and it's really cool. And the food's superb. They've got a patisserie, which is right up my street with my sweet tooth.
Well, we've done outside, Bledge. What about Spike Bar? Should I start off? I'm going to start off in the UK. Have you been to Porthcawl? You mean to Royal Porthcawl?
Yes, it's a cool clubhouse. Yeah, yeah, enjoy that. Yep,
I think that's a cracker, and all the furniture is there's all the nooks and crannies, and you know, service second to none. Fantastic place. So there's my starter for 10. Let's rustle through a few of these, Bledge. Where would you have
Ballybunion?
Oh,
fantastic! Great view. Best chicken wings I've had outside of the States. And a lovely pint of Guinness.
Famous, famous on the West Coast for their
I think the clubhouse is made even better as well when you get inside after horrendous weather. means even more, doesn't it, really?
It does. I'm going to keep it rolling and say Blackwell. I think Blackwell, the proper spike bar, the weirdest little room in the world with the flagstone floor, and you know, you have 10 people in there, and then all of a sudden everyone has to stand up because there isn't enough space. And of course, maybe a slightly apocryphal story, but in bounds of the course, if you were to be overzealous on your approach into the 18th green and smash a window, then technically you can go and play it, which I always think is...
Well, I've done that. I've had another clubhouse I've hit in because of you, because of your
You didn't smash a window, though.
No, it certainly did hit the balcony, though, and went, well, hit a big part of the building and went, next, for me, I would say Brancaster.
I have this isn't going well on the do you agree of everything front. I have Brancaster. I think we need to find something that we can argue over instead. What about locker rooms?
Locker rooms. Rye.
Okay. What, post refurb?
Post refurb. And when you come face to face with a naked Ken Hanna in there, that's a sight to behold.
Right. Yeah, well, there you go. Well, I think on all of these metrics, maybe we should have a spin-off on their own for the showers, for all of those bits. But maybe one last question that was a special request, which is a debate in itself. Before we move on to the proper things, and feel free to keep fast forwarding if you've not listened to a word we've said. If you had four taps behind the bar, Bledge, what would come out of them if you poured them?
Right, I would have a lager shandy for my refreshment, because John McLaughlin really got me into lager shandies last year and they were amazing. So that would be the first one. I'd have a Guinness. I love Guinness as a winter drink. Can it be wine as well?
Why the hell not? It's your bar, Bledge. You do what you want.
Yeah, I love a wee white wine, agave. Or agave. I'll have a bottle of Blue Nun, please. And then the fourth one... I really like the Cruz Campo lager these days. I used to drink it as a youth in Spain, and I think it's a brilliant lager, but it's going to be cheapened by the fact that you can just get it all over the shop now. But that was always a prime lager, you know?
You won't be allowed back in Scotland for not suggesting Tenants.
Oh, right, okay, I didn't think I was allowed.
You'll be locked out the border.
Yeah, no, Tenants then, 100%. And the Galloway Golf Club where I did my apprenticeship always prided themselves having the best pint of Tenants anywhere in the town because of the way they cleaned their taps. And it's still, whenever I go back to the Galloway and have a pint of Tenants, it's still superb. But I don't understand. I wish they would have it in England. It's such a shame. It's a fine, fine lager. There you go. Backtracked enough. Is that fine?
It is funny the things that you cross the border and get, like a Tunnocks in your hotel room. Is always, you know, when do you ever see that in south of the border?
The last time we stayed at Troon, we had that. But it just shows you how anglified I am now, the fact that Tenants didn't even cross my mind there.
I probably spent more time in Scotland than you now. Shameful. What about, you're not having Kimmel coming out of one of your taps, Bledge?
I don't mind Kimmel. I don't mind it. I've always been... had a penchant for a silver bullet at the hut at Deal, which is Kimmel and vodka, and seeing four or five balls. a very funny story. Myself and Sean from Burtdale played Deal once, and at the hut, the guy in the hut said, look, you probably want to give the two in front a bit of time because they've had eight whiskey marks. And a couple of silver bullets and some cans of Heineken. And so we let them go ahead. And by the time we got round to 14, we were standing waiting on the tee, and one of them was actually lying on his back on the 14th approach. And then it's the same again on the 18th, and his friend had to come in and then to come back out and pick him up and take him back in. And I love that. I think that's amazing. But yeah, that's Whiskey Max and Silver Bullets. But Silver Bullet is that's a hardcore tipple.
There's probably a joke there somewhere about seeing four balls on the tee, and it's meant to be a two-ball course, isn't it? But we'll think on that one. Why don't we talk instead now, Bledge, about the actual golf courses, seeing as that is really what I suppose is the one bit of insight we might be able to offer if we really try hard. And I want you to reflect on your favorite golf courses, and you can say as many as you want, but then I want you to nail it down and pick just three.
Right. So I've written 11 here. Right. So I'll just reel through them a lot, and then you can pull me up on them. Is that how this is going to go? Right. Here we go.
Yeah, I think so.
They're in no particular order: Sunningdale Old, St Andrews Old, King's Barnes, Portrush, Royal County Down, Royal Cinqports, Royal St George's, Royal Birkdale, Royal Elm St Anne's, Gleneagles Kings, Whisper Rock, Lower.
Oh, okay. That's the anomaly, I would say, in that list in terms of you were saying Royal and Kings quite a lot. Mm-hmm. I think every course that you said up until Whisper Rock either had King or Royal in its name, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But what would you, come on, I'm going to push you now, because you can't have that many. That's ridiculous. What would be the one that you write down? What was the one you wrote down first?
Sunningdale Old's my absolute favourite, but the old course is the one that I've only played once, but the experience blew my mind, and I would love to play it again and again. You know, if I had to play one golf course for the rest of my life, it would be one of them too.
I wouldn't... Surprise, surprise. Wouldn't disagree with you that one. Sunningdale Old. I must say, just to give a slightly nerdy additional bit, I always think at Sunningdale, and both of them are bloody fantastic, but I think that, you know, you have driving courses and you have second shot courses. And what I kind of mean by that is there are courses that really, really challenge you off the tee. And if you're not driving the ball well, you will not really be able to enjoy them. They will be tough. And for me, I always think that the new is a driving course. If you're not driving the ball well on the new, which is a bit tighter, a bit longer, arguably has some of the best par threes on the entire property on the new. But what a fantastic course it is. Whereas the old, slightly shorter, a bit quirkier, more blind shots, more. I do always think every time I'm lucky enough to go back and play it, I just increasingly think it is the embodiment of a second shot golf course, where you don't necessarily have to be crushing driver all day. You can hit a few more irons and a few more woods, but you've got to be coming in from the right spots, because it's all about how you feed into those just the most magnificent set of greens. In Heathland Golf, really. So, yeah, I think you're on safe ground.
And I love putting. Putting's the only thing that I'm kind of half decent at, and as a result, managed to can putt from pretty much anywhere around there. So that was a big thing as well. But it just gets you, you know. I think the occasion, the first couple of holes, and then when you start to turn and walk back in towards the old grey tune, and
where are we talking about here? I thought we were talking about Sunningdale.
I've gone off on an absolute tangent. I'm dreaming.
the old course is also pretty good.
Yeah, well, I thought you, when you were talking about driving off the tee, then you were talking about the old course, because that's exactly what that's about.
No, I was talking about Sunningdale Old and New.
I thought you were talking about St Andrews Old and New.
But sneakily, also true of that course, well, those two courses as well.
That's why I got lost there, because
you're a level ahead of me, Bledge.
Yeah, there we go.
So does that mean that Sunningdale Old and the Old are two of your three?
Exactly. Yeah. Definitely. Okay. And if I was to pick, if you're making me pick three and one more, I'm not going to pick Royal Cinque Ports because it would just be too predictable, you know. And Gleneagles Kings. I've had so many great memories of Gleneagles Kings. It's a bloody brilliant golf course, and it's where I shot my lowest ever score when I was with Gav Speedy and Martin. It's the only time I've ever broken 70, so I think I would have to pick that. But I think there's some unbelievable golf holes at Gleneagles Kings.
I completely agree. I think it's one of the best pieces of land that you find. Interesting, you've got two inland sort of heathland or
mixed it right up.
Ostensibly heathland for you know, at one point heathland courses there. And only one links. I'm looking at my list, and again, I'm gonna try and be slightly less obvious. And
I would never be able to guess your list in a million years.
Go on, what do you think?
Cypress Point.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty good.
Old Course, and it would be somewhere at the back of beyond in the Scottish Highlands and Islands, probably. That would be a third one.
Well, you know what? I could have said Cypress the Old and Dornoch or something, and that probably would be true. But equally true, I'm going to say Portmarnock. Portmarnock is one of my absolute favourite courses, and I don't think it gets the love that arguably it deserves. Because, of course, if you look at Ireland and Northern Ireland, and you were to say, where are you going to play golf? And, you know, there are so many big, famous names. You know, the Hinch, Ballybunion, Royal County Down, Portrush. There are just absolute standout courses over there. But the one, for me, I always think if you go somewhere once and you love it, would you still love it just as much or more if you were then to play it 10 times or 100 times? Mm-hmm. And I always have this little theory that there are certain places that you go and they knock your socks off on day one because, you know, it could be something, it could just be as simple as you played well, or you had great company, a great day, or it could be the views were spectacular, or it did something remarkable that, you know, made it special on that one occasion. And then would that still be the case if you then played it every single day? And I always think that's a test of golf courses. You know, do they still sparkle by the time that you don't notice the view as much, and you've played crap around there a bunch of times, and you know, is it still just as good? For me, it's probably a debate in itself, actually, Bledge, like how the culture of golf and how it is consumed by us as golfers has changed the way golf courses are actually built. And I guess what I'm getting at there is generally who brings the most revenue into golf clubs? Visitors. What is the way that you, how do you get visitors there? Well, you've got to be highly ranked, and you've got to be marketable. So, you know, I guess a signature hole, as Trent Jones might have said, or, you know, something that is a hook to get somewhere, to get someone there once, has arguably become more important than not concerning yourself with trying to just do a few knockout things, but, you know, have something that gets better every single time you play it. And I would say if you were to look at some of those courses that are rattled off there in Ireland, Portmarnock is, you know, yes, it has its very, very impressive arrival and it's the most sumptuous, beautiful clubhouse and pretty good pint of Guinness in there. Yeah. And the first tee is right on the water. It's spectacular. And, you know, maybe the 15th hole is one of the most picturesque par threes that you'll find. But I really, really believe that's not what makes it special. it is the embodiment of that, that, you know, sort of getting better every single time you play it. And for me, it's holes like 14 or 8 or even 13 as a par 5. It's always really hard to find a really, really good par 5. But I think holes that you play them once and then you kind of think afterwards, oh, I wish I played that a bit differently. I wish I could just go back and try and...
And not top it.
And not top it. But, you know, try and do it a bit differently. And you can only do that on really, really good golf courses. You can't do that on places that, you know, it's just a bit more superficial. So, I think that's one that I try.
I always had said that you know a really good golf course that you've loved because you can lie in bed a month, 6 months, a year later and remember the route and the course. It's because it's made an impact on you. And if it's really, really special, you can remember actually where you hit it. And the last time I played Sunningdale Old, probably over a year ago, and I could probably tell you where I hit most of my shots, to be honest, which is, that's pretty crazy considering I can't even remember people's names.
Yeah, well, why don't we very briefly, before we talk about holes, give some shout outs to new, did you do this one? I added this one in quite late, new golf courses, like last right. 25 yeah. years. You've got, you had Kings Barnes on your list, so I'm guessing that would be one.
Yeah, Kings Barnes, definitely. I mean, that's one golf course that I was really lucky to work at, but the first time I played, I was just like, you cannot wait to get to the next hole. You cannot wait to get to one after that because they just get better and better. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It really is. Castle Stewart or Cabot Highland.
I would say Pledge. 12 and 15 at Kings Barnes would probably get in most people's eclectic 18s if they were nuts. Thinking of. So it does have some remarkable holes.
Yeah, so, it really does. It's great design. And I mean, it's like nice, big, generous fairways. And you struggle to lose a golf ball around there. And it gets people around and it's enjoyable and it's fun. And the service is great. It ticks every box. Great condition, coolest course manager on the planet, Innes Knight, love him. So that's a great place. Our Cabot Highlands, as we call it now, my favourite bunker styles on the planet, love it. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be places you've played. I really enjoyed JCB. I thought there was a great collection of holes at the start and near the end, you know, and I think it's a course that it'll mature with years to come and it'll become a cracking inland golf course and I kind of enjoyed it more so than many others of that standard. But yeah, how about yourself? It's a difficult one, that, without kind of thinking about it. Don't play many new courses.
I think, you know, if I think of the sort of, I'm just trying to think of what would make what courses I have played. So I played the Grove the other day. I've played JCB as well, Kings Barnes, Castle Stewart, Dunbarney, Castle Course.
Ah, Dunbarney, yeah, that was great.
I would say of the ones that I've played, I completely agree, Kings Barnes and Castle Stewart for me are great. St. Patrick's, that is...
I'd love to play there.
St. Patrick's, you know, well, it's a few years old now, but the new course at Rosapenna, the Doak course that the Angler Moser and Clyde Johnson and I think Eric Iverson might get some hate mail. They shaped and built for Frank and John Casey, the guys who own Rosapenna over on northwest, but it's an island, but it's sort of right up on the north. That is just so good. So like I think that is. I never thought I'd go to a golf course that would be a proper links course. Like, you know, Castle Stewart and Kings Barnes and Dunbarney, you know, they are fabricated links courses. And some, that's really hard to do. I think that it really then is tricky to have one that looks authentically links and not like they've modeled it off I'm trying to be polite. I just won't say anything at all. It's tough to get it. It's tough to get it looking really good. And I think Castle Stewart, King's Barnes, but so rarely, Linksander so protected. I didn't think that you'd see something in the British Isles that could be built on land like that. But St. Patrick's is that, and it's so grand. And it's just so good. And I appreciate.
Are you trying to say that it's like they've made a new golf course that looks like it's ancient?
I guess what I'm saying is, rarely do you actually get access to proper links land nowadays, because not for a new golf course, because it's generally protected. So more often than not, if you've got a links style golf course, it's in a former potato fields that people have moved earth around and probably sand capped to try and give it a feel of links golf. So I'm saying for St. Patrick's, that's point number one, the fact that they had access to proper sand dunes and were able to build a course from scratch on it from ecological reasons and all the rest of it. So that's number one. Number two is then how do you have what is such a rare opportunity and not cock it up, actually build something that is legitimately world class. And I appreciate that there'll be people who have played it who maybe they played it very, very early. It hadn't been open for very long, and the greens might not have grown in the way that they would have hoped, or they played it once. I actually think, reflecting, Bledge, that the point that I tried to make earlier of, golf courses being built for a one hit and go and never returning and just playing once, which to my mind is disastrous, because great golf courses, you need to see more than once to properly understand them. I think St. Patrick's might actually fall victim to that, to this one more than others, because when I went, I was lucky enough, I think I might have played it like 7 times in 3 days or 4 days or so, we were just playing it on repeat, and every time you play it, it gets better and better, but it's big and bold, and it's not about hitting it down the middle. It's about, really, really going mega, mega wide, because there's a big hill or something right on the approach to the green. So if you hit a straight drive and a straight approach, you'll walk up and the shot that you thought was perfect is in a bunker or is in absolute deathsville, and you just go, what a load of crap, stupid hole. But the other approach is actually you shouldn't have hit it there. You should have hit it all the way over there and use the massive slope to let it feed round. And if you just go once and the greens aren't really running, then that you might not have been able to see all of those brilliant subtleties that the guys put into it. But I think St. Patrick's is as good as it's as all the accolades that it's received, I think are worth it. So that would be one.
I'd love to go across.
And I've got one more, which is in America. Oh, I forgot to mention, there's another two that I could have said, which would have been new links courses, Mac Dunes, Macrahanish Dunes, and Trump's Aberdeen place.
I haven't played Trump's.
But I'm happy to stick with my selections.
How old Skibo?
Well, Skibo, I think it's like 30 years now, and has been, but was really rebuilt a few years ago. So yeah, that would be another one. And I do like Skibo, actually. Skibo is one I'd throw in there.
It's great. And G West, which crying shame.
Course it could have been.
But that's the most outrageously awesome golf course.
I've got one more for our international listeners, Bledge. Which is a course just sort of in the hills near Malibu, north of LA, which is called Rustic Canyon, which people may or may not have heard of. Google Rustic Canyon. And it was built by Gil Hance Jim Wagner and a friend of the podcast, Jeff Shackelford. I don't know, maybe it's just a little older than my arbitrary sort of deadline, but I'm going to include it. I played there, and I think it was like $30 green fee. Like, just phenomenally good value. And yeah, it's a bit rugged and all the rest of it, but Christ, you know, it's basically just outside of LA where golf is not cheap.
It's cool, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's absolutely magnificent. If anyone has played, if anyone's played Rustic Canyon, you know, please write in and tell me if you agree or disagree. But if there was somewhere I could send people for a really, really, you know, extraordinary round of golf, for remarkable value, it would be that place.
Although quite I'm a such commute. A big fan of the open sand between holes as opposed to long rough. I think that's why I enjoyed desert golf so much, along with seeing road runners. But the fact that, I mean, you could actually lose a lot of golf balls at Rustic Canyon because there's a lot of kind of growth in there. But I mean, the open sand's just so good, isn't it?
And when there are certain places where it just looks absolutely fantastic. I sort of have skirted a few times around Cypress Point on here because I don't want to be that guy. But you know what, Bledger? I think it's probably worth... So at Cypress, because water in California is such an issue, droughts and all the rest of it, irrigating golf courses in that part of the world is a real hot topic. I think, you know, it's something that they're all thinking about. I think at Pasatiempo, I've probably said this previously on the podcast because I just found it so baffling, but at Pasatiempo, they get their water, which is grey water, that they have their own treatment plant from a local prison. Have I said that on the pod before?
God.
I think they spent like $10 million building their own water treatment plant to sort of recycle the water that was being shipped, you know, or whatever it is. I might have elaborated and made some things up,
did you say shipped out?
Yes, there was definitely a couple of P's in there. I would have put an A in the word otherwise. But at Cyprus, when they had Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw, arguably the, you know, the top of the shop in terms of architects working today, come and refurbished the course a few years ago. And one of their briefs, I think, was to limit the amount of grass on the golf course for that exact reason, for the amount of water. So every blade of grass on there has been thought, do we need this, yes or no? And one of the things that they do, and it was particularly evident on the seventh hole. So at Cypress, you know, you start off and you're slightly overawed that you're in this mystical place and you play the first and then you sort of enter this wasteland for the second, and then you play the par three, then you play back to back par fives, which are five and six. You know, if you talk about a course that breaks every rule in the book, you know, got to be par 72, got to have two par threes, two par fives on the front nine, two par threes, two par fives on the back nine, spread them all out. You know, Cypress breaks every single rule. So you play back-to-back par fives on five and six, and then seven is a par three, and it's sort of an uphill par three benched into the side of this enormous sand dune, not, you know, different kind of sand over in Monterey than what we might call the sand dune, but you know, that's what it is. And it's just this glistening in the sunshine because the colors there are so vibrant and so dramatic. But it's just when you were saying about that and holes separated by sand, I did think on that reason as well, there is more than just aesthetics, and there the aesthetics are off the charts, but so too is the practical benefit of sort of having that sand from a water. water point of view.
But and just, looking at all, I mean, going back to Rustic Canyon, I'm doing the flyovers here, which are brilliant. And we've got the 1-18 flyovers, which I implore, if that's the right word, everyone to look at. But the this is obviously going to play proper hard and fast. Massive big surrounds, flows into tees, sand everywhere. So that this is a like an inland links, isn't it, really?
Have a look, Bledge, and I'd encourage the listeners, why don't we move on to favourite holes? And if we're going to do that, the third hole at Rustic Canyon, if you've watched that fly over there.
I'll go back. I'm on six. Oh, yeah, this is cool. Yeah.
That hole there, you'll probably recognise if you think about it. I'll encourage the listeners to have a look at the third hole at Rustic Canyon because it's the 10th hole at Riviera. Like it's obviously not, you know, it's different in many, many ways, but at its essence, it's the same as the 10th hole at Riviera. Mm. You know, do you play over the bunkers out left and get the angle down the green? So I think, you know, if we're talking about favorite holes,
an easy shot, then you've got the bunkers.
When do you take on the danger? Do you take it on the drive and have an easier second, or do you shun the danger on the drive and have a harder second? You know, it's that's got to be a starting point there, Bledge.
I dream about the day that I'm good enough to stand in the tee and have options. Like you talk about all these options, my only option in that hole, right, is just keep it safe.
Which is normally always the right option to take.
Oh God almighty. It's depressing.
But that's why it's like a stuck record on the fairway stuff. Not that we're going to talk about that now, but you know, these holes were built for options when the fairways were like 60 yards wide. So you basically had two fairways to aim at. Now if you've got one fairway that's 30 yards wide, then yeah, there's no one in the world who's good enough to say, oh yes, I'm going to go for the right hand edge of a 26 yard wide fairway. It's like, no, it's rubbish. So rather than get on our stuck record, Bledge, what's your starting point for favorite holes?
So there's a hole that I always really look forward to playing, and that is the 12th at Royal St. George's. I do think, and Royal St. George's from a stretch of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, probably the best stretch of holes I've ever played. But when you get round to 12, I just love that hole. I always play it really well. And I think if you love a hole, you play it well. It's been a while since I had a really bad drive on there. And it's usually a wedge, driver wedge for me. I always kind of play it kind of straight on. I never try and bite off too much of the corner. Driver wedge in the green is super well protected, and some deep, proper deep bunkers at the front, and then at the end it, you're rewarded with a drink and some food.
I wondered if that was going to be part of the attraction.
So I just adore that golf hole. It's brilliant. How about you? Hit me.
I was trying to think.
Or will we talk about that one a bit more? Do you want to talk about that?
Well, no, because we need to stop agreeing on things.
We need to wrap it up.
Look, I would say let's disagree and say I'm not disagreeing too vehemently because I think the 12th is great as well. But 4 for me at Sandwich is, it's got to be the best hole there. Surely the 4th
hole. Can we put the sleepers back in?
I bloody love that. For those who you described the 12th there, the 4th is the famous drive over the sort of Himalaya bunker that they have into the dune there. And I love it because a lot of these holes, certainly a lot of the ones that I've put on my list, and in a perverse way, Bledger, I'd like you to talk about the 6th at Deal. But you know, compare it to what I'm about to say here. There was a bloke 100 years ago, Max Burr, who used to write about the line of instinct and the line of charm. And I realize this is, again, quite nerdy, but I think it's a theme. We always really want listeners to, you know, sort of think a little bit about the what makes a good hole, what makes, that's why we're sort of having this discussion really. And it's something that I think is, if you know it and if you understand it, then you'll see it a lot more often in the holes that you just innately think are good holes. So Bear would say line of instinct. The line of instinct for most golfers is they stand on the tee, they pull a driver out, and they smack it at the green because it's the shortest route. Why wouldn't you do that? And the really good holes are where he would say you should instead seek out what he described as the line of charm. And the line of charm is not the instinctual route to the hole. It is actually taking perhaps a longer route or taking on what might seem a more dangerous or you know, exactly the reasons we're saying there. You've got to play out to sort of unlock something. For me, that is so evident in the fourth hole. If you stand on the fourth tee, where, Bledge, how often would you say, in all the times you've played at Royal St. George's, if you've hit a drive, how many times have you missed the fairway left and how many times have you missed the fairway right?
More often left. And that's hitting between the two bunkers. That's the line.
It's so uncomfortable to aim far enough right off that tee because, you know, you're hitting where you can't see the ball land. It's blind, which always makes you uncomfortable. You've got to hit it over this massive, intimidating dune with the biggest bunker that you'll ever see. And as you say, even more intimidating when it used to have sleeper faces on the bunker. So if you do hit it outright, if you do hold your nerve and take it way, way outright, then you're going to have a flat stance, because the fairway is completely flat over there and much further right than anyone would believe the first time they play it. So they've got a flat stance. And yes, it's not a short club that you're hitting into the green. It's always going to be a long club. It's a 4.5, really. It's a long hole. But you can hit the ball straight at the flag then, and chances are it's going to run up the big false front. It's more than a false front. It's like a two-step green, isn't it?
But it's going... It's like the green's halved, essentially, isn't it? Half's on the slope, half's at the back. Probably, I don't know.
But you can run the ball up, and it will stop, you know, if you've hit a good shot. Whereas most people, it's so far right, you pull it left. It's, you can kind of see the green almost, depending where the flag is, over all the hills on the inside line. But you're going to have a stance that is crooked as hell. And that's assuming you miss that bunker that's just a small blind bunker that's down there. And if you do have a chance of going for the green in two, you're playing diagonally across that ridge in the green. And you're gonna end up kicking off down the right, or maybe even worse, you've turned the ball over and you go all the way long left. You know, short right, long left are the misses for most right-handed golfers. So you think about it in those terms, and you've run off there. It's just, you know, you can hit really good shots on bad lines, and absolutely struggle to make force. But if you hit average shots on good lines on that hole, then you probably can make a four, or certainly no worse than a five.
And would you like to know now where the sleepers are from that bunker?
Go on.
Bit of trivia for our listeners. They are in the bank of the walkway at the 13th hole at Deal on the tee bank.
Did you steal them?
Yeah, well, they were donated, that's where they ended up. We were looking for some old rusty sleepers and rustic sleepers, and they had them lying about. And it's just nice that they're actually still
R.I.P.
still kicking about. Really, it's a wee bit of kind of history between the clubs, which I've always really enjoyed. And so the next time anyone plays 13th at Deal, just where the ball washer is, we put them on, and they're there to kind of study the bank up. But I know they look great.
Yeah, well, what else is on your great hole list, Bledge?
Where else? Let's keep away from Deal and Hoylake in that case then. How about the postage stamp? Because yes, we've got the Open obviously coming up at Royal Troon. I lucky enough to play Royal Troon 3 times, and the postage stamp was on a Wintergreen twice, and I birdied it twice in the Wintergreen, which is the best thing ever, because it's like a punch bowl, isn't it? A hollow, and the ball
that's
always
the
ends
one that's
up
long, like long left over
left,
at the bottom.
And you know I love hitting it long left. But then the actual time I came to play the postage stamp, I don't know if I was nervous or the occasion got to me like it did when I played St Andrews, but I don't even think I finished the hole. And so that makes me want to really go back and play it again. But that's a tremendous golf hole. And the bunker on the left, the coffin bunker, is absolutely brutal.
Yes.
Brutal.
Can I...
So I'm looking forward to watching that.
Can I be really nerdy again, Bledge? And... Because, shock horror, I think it's a magnificent hole. But I don't have many par threes actually on my list. When I was pulling my list together, I wrote holes down. And I got to a point, and I'd written quite a few of holes that I really love. And I looked, and there weren't many par threes on there. And I kind of thought about it, and I've talked at length on this specific episode and many previous ones about why I love holes as a sort of, you got to hit it here to hit it there. And obviously on a par three, it's one shot. You're on the tee, there's the green, you hit one shot. And I think if most people wrote a list of 100 of fantastic par threes, they'd actually be writing a list of 100 of the best looking par threes, you know, the most beautiful par threes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you wrote a list of the best 100 par fives, I very, very much doubt that people would write a list of the 100 most beautiful par fives, because par fives aren't really beautiful. They're long. And then, you know, what makes a great par five is how you think your way along it. And, you know, there'd be holes like the sixth at Carnoustie, you know, Hogan's Alley and all that kind of stuff, or 14 at the Old Course. And again, it's all about being daring with the out of bounds and all that kind of stuff. But the point I'm making is great par threes, more often than not, I would say, rely on being very, very beautiful, dramatic, daring holes that, you know, you play and you love them, and that doesn't make them a lesser quality of hole. It's just maybe a little bit of an unfair observation, but the postage stamp is actually a bloody clever hole, and it's dramatic, and it's famous, and it's beautiful. And the reason why I think it's so good is, do you know how deep the green is front to back on the postage stamp?
I have not got a clue.
Well,
tell me.
This is slightly my neurodivergence here, relying on long lost trivia, so it might be completely wrong, but I think it's about 100 feet from front to back. And
but can we go and I need to get Google out.
You go and measure it. I think it's 90 something feet. But the point is it's very, very long front to back. Now, what that means, to my mind at least, is it's also not circular. The green isn't circular or square as a postage stamp. It's almost triangular, I suppose you'd describe it. I think it's about twice the width in the first third as it is in the back third. So like if you were to measure the width of the green from a front pin position and the width of the green at a back pin position, I think it is 2 times wider at the front pin position than it is at the back pin position. So the reason why I think that's key, and another really important little attribute of the hole, even though it is famous for being a green atop a small dune with big bunkers running off, big runoffs all around it, a key sort of often neglected fact to mention is the tee is even higher than the green. So you are still, even though the green is raised, you are hitting down from a higher position to the green, which means, of course, that you can judge the wind, you can flight the ball, and have a lot more chance in doing so. But the reason why that width of the green and the fact that this is so long is, to my mind, a neglected fact that people don't really talk about, is the fact that you stand on the tee and have a choice, which is rare on a par three. And that choice is, if the pin is at the back of the green, and let's say that means that it's 120 yards, whatever it is arbitrarily, you could, you know, shoot it with your Bushnell and pull out your 120 yard shot. If you do that, you have got to be twice as accurate playing a 120 yard shot than if you were to play a 100 yard shot. And if you're playing a 100 yard shot, you are going to be more accurate than a 120 yard shot because you've got more loft on the ball. So the point is, you can stand there and be aggressive or slightly conservative, but if you play a 100 yard shot, not a 121, you've got a really long putt. So it's so rare, I think, on a hole that is, the beauty of it is it's so short. You look at it and go, I've got to make a birdie here. I've got to be really aggressive. And you know what? The guys in the Open this year, it'll be so interesting to watch them. When the pin's at the back, I would be so interested to see how many of them actually get it pin high and how many of them actually take one club less, which being so long, you have that option to do, and then leave themselves probably, you know, a 20 foot straight down the length of the green, you know, from the middle of the green to the back pin. How many of them actually look to play short of the pin? And I think that's a really neglected little attribute of that hole.
I think it's measuring at about 32 yards long, it looks like.
So
that's a decent one. Do you know how long the 12th green at King's Barnes was? Because I used to cut it and put a pipe straight from start, from front to back.
Go on, a long way, I'm guessing.
70 yards.
70 yards long.
Yeah.
So over 200 feet.
It's 70 yards, yeah. It's crazy.
That is nuts.
I used to always think it was 80, but I've just Google Earthed it and it's 70.
Can you see what I'm saying about the greens? Can you see what I was saying about the width of the green?
Yeah. It narrows right down at the back. Yeah.
It just tapers away. Every yard you go further. You know, you don't want to be missing that green long. It's just grass down there, but you'd much rather have a little puss up the hill. So
here we go. This is it then, Sam. One hole left. You're gonna. Tomorrow's your last day on Earth. Just been announced. You've got one hole, one course, and one hole. Hit me.
And you're playing it
on. You've got an hour to live. You've got one hole.
And you can play it on repeat. Can I keep playing it on repeat?
I'm dying
in an hour. So.
You got an hour's worth of life left in you.
Okay, well, I will be cliche and go back to Cypress Point, but I'm not going to say 16 or 15. I'm going to say it would be one of either 8 or 9. They've got back-to-back par fours, and they're short par fours, and I think, I don't care which, you just... They're the holes that, you know, people know about 12, people know about 15 and 16. But I think maybe 9 would be the one for me that you just play. Although if I've only got an hour left, it's quite a steep walk, so it might finish me off earlier. So maybe that's a really stupid idea. But I'll stick with it. What would you do, Bledge?
I'd probably go to the bar. I'd probably use the time wisely.
So you'd play the 12th at Royal St. George's and play it really quickly. Concede yourself the person's
speed golf it and then go see Trish. I'd be done.
Well, that is on brand.
It's been a night of difficult questions. Like there's I think we probably what we try and get across is, yeah, we're saying that these are some of our favourites. But do you know, if we did this podcast again tomorrow night, my answers would maybe be a lot different, because, and I think that's the beauty of and how lucky we are to work and live in this life of golf, that we get subjected to a lot of these incredible golf courses and holes. And it's only when you speak about it at this length, you see actually how lucky we have been. You know,
I think that's the absolute beauty of it, is there are a million reasons to love a golf hole, and not, you know, one is not more important than another. But the whole idea, I guess, Bledge, for me at least, is I get to learn what goes into maintaining a hole a little bit more. And I do find when I go and play a new course now, I spot things that you have pointed out that I would never really have noticed before, you know, little mowing lines and little details and things like that. So I think that there is so much benefit in all golfers just being a little bit more thoughtful and thinking about the place they play golf, because how lucky are we, as you say, to have almost an infinite number of golf holes out there, certainly more than any person, even Sprezzatura, could play in a lifetime. another Instagram account, which is almost more of a true crime account to follow rather than a golfing. But you know what I mean? There's a million golf holes out there. What makes them so special? What makes them interesting? And the more we all think about it, I think the more we get to enjoy them.
Mm-hmm. Super stuff. Well, it's a great chat tonight. Thoroughly enjoyed that. We'll not have time tonight to cover it, but we're going to also talk about our favourite machines, or my favourite machines, our favourite golf clubs, and I was desperate to get in music as well, because I wanted everyone to know about your music taste, Sam.
Well, you managed to get in, and the fact that you Swiftie obsession.
Every single word.
Feels quite pointed.
We got a journey through Taylor Swift's eras.
Well, Bledge, it was a really lovely episode. Lovely to speak to you. And on that bombshell, let's catch up next time, and we'll get to all of the points. Take it easy, mate.
Super. Right, night, everyone.